Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. You are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center and have on the political right in studio, Senator Dan McKay.
Oh, it's good to visit with you guys again.
Nice to be with you, Dan. And on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. So glad you're with us.
We've been talking right as the program gets started here about how I really like this President Sheinbaum in Mexico.
Okay, tell us what's standing out for you. What do you love?
I hear she has an 80% approval rating.
Yeah.
And every time our president-elect says something that kind of gets under her skin, she's got something to fire back that I think would get under Donald Trump's skin.
Yeah.
Her latest is, as our listening audience might remember, he talked about calling it the Gulf of America instead of the Gulf of Mexico. And she's, you know, looking back and saying, well, let's just call it the Mexican America. And, you know, drawing back to the 1607 Constitution of Mexican America. I mean, she's clever.
Yeah, she is. I think it's also going to be a really interesting time given the stepping down of Trudeau in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
What seems to be a really powerful moment arise for her politically, certainly, to see these kind of different environments playing out at both of our borders when it comes to a style and dealing with Trump, but also dealing with really serious questions around economic trade, around national security. So I will be curious to see how things are going. But we did note that Mexico is sending a contingent of firefighters to Los Angeles, and I do think that's classy. I think that's wonderful. I'm grateful.
Yeah.
It's an interesting time.
Dan, those ties between California and Mexico run deep.
Deep.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's always so it's good in a lot of ways to see that there's still the ability to collaborate, despite the fact that, you know, the two leaders of the various countries, they may not see eye to eye.
But
when you get down to where the rubber meets the road, I did think it was great that they sent, you know, firefighters and not equipment because, you know, most states that are sending equipment, stuff's getting stopped at the border for safety inspections and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
To pass California emissions and all these other things.
So
they've actually sent some stuff. So
for firefighters, that's been debunked. The firefighters have been able to cross over.
But funny nonetheless.
Misinformation's
right?
Hilarious.
So we have this firsthand from Utah firefighters who have said that about Utah equipment.
Okay.
So that being said,
it's just been widely reported.
It's good to see that the two can work together and that people can still get stuff done.
Yeah.
Dan, tell me on the Mexico situation with our incoming president, you know, it's going to be interesting to watch the dynamics between China and Mexico vis-a-vis trade in our country, because as people stop doing as much trade, stop working as much with China, whether it's because of tariffs or whatever, Mexico looms large there. And I see Mexico as a very strategic economic play for our country right now.
Yeah. You know, Ulysses S. Grant, this goes back way back, right? For back to 1607 with Sheinbaum, we can go a little more current. But Grant
1870s?
Wanted, yeah, we can go to 1870s, post-Civil War presidency. But, you know, Ulysses S. Grant wanted Mexico to be part of the United States at one point. And there was, you know, there was a whole dust-up over the Dominican Republic during his presidency about them actually being part of the United States as well, like Puerto Rico and others and the Virgin Islands. And so instead of that dust-up, that little concern he had there, it ended up not making Mexico part of the United States, which probably was good for Mexico. But you look at the balance of like these long-term trade relations and how those things are going to impact China. And then you see Venezuela, you see Maduro, who's still, you know, poking at Trump on the other side about why don't we go reclaim Puerto Rico, right? And you know, kind of goading Brazil into doing something like that. This, the dynamics of China as it interplays with, you know, with trade and the entire basically south of the border relations is going to be probably the biggest story economically for the next 4 or 5
keep
years.
Keep an eye on it. Shireen, it's Senate confirmation time for the incoming cabinet for Donald Trump. It looks like real early up will be the defense pick, Pete Hegseth.
Yeah.
And then not far behind that will be the Secretary of Interior nominee, Doug Burgum.
Yeah. So
two contrasting picks there, by the way.
Two contrasting picks.
One I support, one I'm sort of like, lukewarm on.
Yeah. Tell me how you can get to lukewarm on Pete Hegseth.
Because I do believe that you should give the person who is elected broad authority to pick who they want on their team.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So clearly we have in this country not a real problem with folks who have been accused, often credibly, of rape, you know, getting into positions of power. So that is I guess not something that we're going to consider here.
She's giving you easy stuff there, Dan.
I would say that this, what's difficult about this is, I think, you know, when I think about the kind of radicalization that, that I'm worried about in the United States military, when we think about the recent attacks that we've seen domestically from folks coming out of Fort Bragg, when we think about the rates of sexual violence that, that women in the military experience, I think there are many reasons that I would find this person unqualified. But I would also say I do think people deserve a hearing. I hope that that is one that is done with a thorough eye towards what are the actual professional responsibilities and background that we would want someone to have coming into these roles. As snoozy as I find Doug Burgum to be, former governor now at this point, I guess, of North Dakota, or still, I guess, I do think that that's a person who brings a professional background that feels like more of a fit for the role.
Yeah.
Ideologically different, but has a true expertise and has spent time in the industry.
Yeah. Dan?
I think all of these appointments are out of the box. They are not people that are, you know, there are a few exceptions, obviously, but I think it represents what I think Trump is figuring out from the election, which is Americans, there is a growing frustration with Washington, D.C., and with their spending habits and with their growth and the growth trajectory of what Washington is doing. They'd rather those decisions be made at local levels as opposed to being made at the national level. And then you inject that with federal mandates for, you know, policies that go back and forth between, you know, you got a Republican president and the initiative changes. And so the local government has to turn on a swivel to deal with that. And then a Democrat takes over and you have to turn on the swivel to change to meet those policies, and trying to have a project that is like continuous and actually able to be implemented. We saw 10 years ago, California is the prime example. 10 years ago, all the voters voted to come up with a giant bond to help solve some of the water infrastructure needs. Okay. And because government is so difficult to deal with, not only in California, but also in D.C. as it relates to some of these projects, because the Army Corps is involved, you've just got a difficult regulatory environment for people to be effective. And I think everybody's kind of frustrated with everything being done in D.C. and not having some of this control at the local level. And so the mandate, I think, if President Trump has one, it is break this thing up, change the way we're doing business.
Yeah. So last week I was at lunch with a good friend of mine, and she's pretty excited about the Trump administration. And she said, Natalie, it's not going to be as bad as you think. And you know what? I want this incoming president to succeed. And I want the theory that Dan just spelled out to work. Like, I want where we need reforms in the federal government, I want them to happen. It's just not my style, you know, the way this incoming president goes about it. But I'm rooting for him.
Okay.
I hope you are too, Sheree.
You know who I'm rooting for? I'm rooting for the American people. And I think at the end of the day, we deserve a functional government, whether that's at the local or at the federal level. Certainly, at, you know, at the state level, it's important down to your city government. You want it to function well. I think you want people who enter public service to have a orienting core around, I would hope, you know, altruism, justice, truth, building a better future. That's not how I see the Trump administration or Donald Trump. I see Trump as an authoritarian who's quite interested in his own power, which is why we're hearing things like talking about purchasing Greenland and all this other stuff. When in the end of the day, what I think we're going to get are more tax cuts for billionaires.
I read a fascinating cover story in The Economist magazine where it talked about how the incoming administration has three camps of people that it has to keep happy. And one was the tech bros. We know who they are, the Elon Musks and so on. The second is the MAGA core. And then the third is the actual conservatives.
Yeah. And trying to keep all those.
Yeah. And all three of them have different interests. And you know, if you think of immigration or different things. So it's going to be quite a test of democracy.
Yeah. I feel obviously slightly different than Shireen as far as
just
authoritarianness. That word gets abused way too frequently, right? I just look at the grand scheme of what needs to be done, and Americans are tired of being so driven from Washington, D.C., and their local lives being influenced from Washington, D.C. I think, and we see this playing out all over the country, the more we decentralize decisions, the better off local decisions get made.
Yeah.
And I think you see that push, and everybody's like, well, it's authoritarian to take over Greenland. It's like, well, it's actually not a war. right? You look at the war it could be if you wanted to, which is where the North Seas are going when you start talking about the difficulties that are going on between Russia and China up in the North Seas. That could be a war, but instead we're looking at a voluntary acquisition, or you know, like that's at least a positive deal maker type deal.
We're also hearing that he's talking about this as an issue of national defense. So I'm just saying the groundwork is being laid.
Because he's got to keep all three groups happy.
Do you remember Dan and Shireen, the definition of a bureaucrat?
No, but I'm sure you've got a great one.
It's a job held by a Democrat that a Republican wants. Yeah. Hey, we have to break to our next segment, but just really quickly before we do that, big Supreme Court decision came down today.
Yeah.
There's a couple of them. Phil Lyman, you know, case not being heard. But the big one is that the state land case is not going to be picked up. And I'd love to hear you comment on that, Dan. This is the part that deals with the unappropriated federal lands. So not national monuments, not national parks, but largely Bureau of Land Management lands that don't really do a whole lot in our state. And the state basically said, hey, those should be ours.
Yeah.
Supreme Court's not even hearing it.
Yeah. I think what the state tried to fast track the process by going directly to the Supreme Court, saying the Supreme Court should have original jurisdiction over the issue, which is really quite a wonky legal thing. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really mitigate the state's ability to continue to litigate this and work with this within the federal government.
So am I probably right in saying that what will happen is that now we'll go the slow process, but we'll still keep it alive and going?
That's what the bureaucrats want.
And I'll just add that it's $500,000 of your taxpayer dollars going to this law firm in Virginia, and $2.6 million, again, of your taxpayer dollars for a public relations campaign that produced nothing. So speaking of government efficiency,
it's
I guess.
It's just as effective as all the DEI measures, so we'll take it out of that.
All right. Hey, let's take a quick break and come back. And Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gurbani and Dan McKay. Stay tuned, everyone.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. That's BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gurbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and we're going to talk local news. How's that sound, Shireen and Dan?
I love local news.
Okay, fine.
All right. So Governor Cox, last week, he went to Mar-a-Lago, visited with President-elect Trump. I guess several other governors were invited. Dan, I'm interested to hear what you know about that, heard about it, but I'll just set it up by saying that the governor had agreed to be at the release of the economic report, the governor. This is a big event in Grand America, 1,000 business leaders there. I think there were like 50 people from the legislature there. And he decided not to go to that in favor of being at Mar-a-Lago. And I just thought, you know, I think I get it because a former president has a lot of power and it's important for our state to be in a position to benefit from that power. But
well, and you have a new administration with a lot of, let's say, the best way to say it, I think, is there's a lot of priorities shifting around or moving around the president right now. If you remember, when he started his first term, one of his first acts of office was he flew to Utah and he, you know, dealt with bear's ears.
Mm-hmm.
And then went back to Washington, D.C. and proceeded to finish his presidency. But that was one of the initial priorities. And you think about the president, you know, and the
and
issues
partly
that are
because of relationship with
Speaker Hughes.
Speaker Greg Hughes.
And trying to, you know, and really trying to make a difference on policies that matter to Utah.
So our governor's creating this relationship with the hope that it benefits Utah strategically.
Yeah.
And that's the reason he has to be there.
And it's always tough for, you know, I'm sure the governor, as he's doing the analysis, he's trying to figure out, well, do I be there while they're carving up, you know, the priorities and making sure, you know, Utah's one of those priorities? Or do I be at home and make sure that I'm there for these important economic relationships?
Shireen, when I worked in Washington, I always felt discriminated against being a Westerner.
Oh, yeah.
Because I had such long travels to be there. And I'd watch as some of my colleagues would head home for the weekend, you know, to be with their kids or whatever. And they'd just take an hour train drive or, you know, ride or whatever. But any comments on the Mar-a-Lago visit?
I was going to say, so maybe we should rethink where we have our nation's capital. And I'm just going to suggest maybe North Dakota.
Love it. Love it. That would help with my issue of the tyranny of distance.
We'll put it on public land and drill for oil and gas underneath it. Brilliant.
It's going great up there.
At this point, you're becoming a very senior legislator, not in age,
crazy,
but in you know, seniority. And you chair a pretty powerful committee, Rev and Tax, as we call it. The budget dominates the session, and lawmakers are setting aside $200 million for another tax cut.
Yeah.
What insights can you share with us?
Well, what we have learned is that, you know, cutting taxes and in right-sizing government is the right thing to do. We wish mm-hmm. D.C. would follow our example to do this, but it's harder. Mm-hmm. We've seen a very, I guess, you know, careful and slow, methodical way to take the tax rates to where they are from, mm-hmm. from where they are to keep us competitive in the global market, or at least in the national market. And, you know, now we have this kind of this waging battle against, you know, you got AARP, which has been lobbying the state for a long time to completely remove income tax from Social Security. Mm-hmm. And the governor's kind of on that page this last year. Or with his budget this year. And then you've got the other side of the coin, which is where I am, which is a rate cut for everybody is a benefit to everybody, right?
So in the income tax.
Yeah, in the income tax.
Not sales,
and
income.
And trying to find ways to cut the income tax, I think, is really the better policy as we mm-hmm. move forward. But there you go.
So getting rid of the tax on Social Security would cost about $143.8 million. And eliminating this tax directly affects about 150,000 Utahns. We're only one of 8 states that still levies this tax. Like, when you're thinking about, you know, older folks, when we're thinking about the cost of living, when we're thinking about the challenges that people are facing, what are you considering? Like, when you think, when you hear that proposal, what goes through your mind?
So it's great to have those numbers, because we're talking about 150,000 Utahns. But there are 150,000 Utahns who are also on Social Security that aren't paying a tax, because everybody that makes $75,000 or less, in other words, Social Security is the sole source of income, right? Then, or slightly more, then they already don't pay income tax on that, right? Which is, I think,
so let's just slow down and explain that to people. So basically, mm-hmm. if you're below a certain income threshold, you're already not paying taxes
that's
on
correct.
That income.
In Utah.
So if this is your only income, for those folks who we would consider, I mean, That's hard living. That can be a tight budget here in Utah, right, at this point, $75,000 a year. But so we're really talking about those folks that are above that threshold.
But it's still over the median income,
yeah.
right? So the $75,000 is still over the median income for the state of Utah. So you look at that number, $75,000, and say, okay, below. And then above that, it's a graduated until I think it's $85,000 that you still pay income tax on.
Yeah.
The problem is, if you give a tax break for people that are making $75,000 or more to completely exempt it for those, you know, $150,000, you leave everybody else who's still making below the median or at median income paying higher taxes. And remember, the only thing you need to do to qualify for Social Security, turn 65.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That is the benchmark. There's no means test to it.
It's kind of a big deal in America these days.
You turn 65.
Huh?
Well, more and more people are turning 65 every day. But that being said, so it's always this difficulty between policy of, you know, a broader base where you get more taxpayers but lower the rate, versus you start carving out and yeah. making special exceptions for political
yeah. Dan,
purposes.
Dan, I realize that, you know, depending on credits and exemptions and things, that the tax base changes dramatically. But I worked in state government when our top tax rate was like 7.25.
Yeah.
And now we're down to 4.65?
4.55.
And are we
and
not?
They might go
and
lower.
For every 5 basis points, it's mm-hmm. $100 million. So
yeah.
I can trim 10 basis points, in mm-hmm. other words, 0.10 mm-hmm. off of that and get mm-hmm. down to 0.45.
Yeah.
And continually like ratchet that down yeah. as we see the need.
I think I can see the writing on the wall here.
Yeah.
That they're going to support. They're not, well, if they support the governor, it will be unlikely. I think it's more likely that they'll just do a rate change.
Well, what are some of the other, I think when we're thinking about tax and, you know, some of the other big decisions that the legislature needs to make, I saw the list of Senate priorities. I don't know if you were part of making those, but I saw things like making life more affordable. You would think something like this would maybe fall into that category. I also saw increasing support for schools and educators. I saw water. What are some of the things that you're hearing about? Maybe some things that haven't been, like, I know you don't want to probably share a lot, but things that haven't been released yet, people should be looking for that you think are going to improve the lives of Utahns.
Well, I think you'll see continued support for both our public employees and for our teachers and public safety. I think we'll see continued support there. And believe it or not,
super happy to hear that.
Yeah, and
they're great people.
The interesting thing is it is harder and harder to give, you know, above market raises or whatever it is, just because of how expensive it is, mm-hmm, right? And mm-hmm. and it's an important sector, and treating one differently than the other isn't very popular. And so, you know, getting everybody and taking care of everybody, I think, is an important, you know, I guess, piece of the puzzle. And then you hear, you know, things like water still being a constant conversation. And then, you know, making affordability and dealing with affordability is important. Housing is going to be another, still going to be a consistent conversation. I mean, I was just talking to a friend of mine who's a realtor, and he was just explaining how, you know, he had people that were coming out to an open house, and they were saying, well, we thought because interest rates were sustained that we would start to see a decrease in pricing in housing. And that just isn't occurring. Mm-hmm. And so you have now people coming into spring, which is the buying time for real estate anyways, but coming into the spring where people are starting to look at the spring and say, well, prices aren't coming down and interest rates aren't coming down. Yeah. So
we're holding.
Yeah. Or this unsatisfied demand of people that are out there, they're still waiting to buy. I think you're going to see a lot of them come forward.
I'm a big believer in our chief economist here at the Gardner Institute, but he, this is Phil Dean, believes that housing affordability is really the number one constraint to growth right now in our state. And I don't mean growth like big growth. I just mean like to opportunity for, you know, people to put food on their table.
Well, and I'll just add this other statistic, and I'm making this public during the legislative session. But again, going back to our Social Security or tax, but wealth accumulation in the state of Utah over the age of 65 has grown significantly over the age of 65 over the last 5-10 years.
Because look at the stock market and look at housing prices.
Yeah. Under the age of 65.
Ownership society.
Under the age of 65, okay, how the wealth has actually decreased over the last 5-10 years for that group. And so if you look at—
And we're leaving them with deficits to pay back.
And we're leaving them with deficits to pay it back. And so I go back to how much do we love our kids, right? Are we going to saddle them with both the liabilities and with the losses? And I can't, for me, that's why I'm struggling with the tax policy of giving tax breaks to people that are already, you know, wealth generated.
Probably doing okay. Yeah, we talked about this, actually. We talked about the age at which people are buying their first home or selling homes, and that has increased in the state. So we know that it's a difficult market
but
to get into.
The average age of first-time home buyers, 39.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
Right? You know, most of us were looking for a house at 24, 25, you know, 30 years ago.
Especially, I mean, I think especially for young Mormons, right? When we're thinking about folks who are starting families earlier, all of that feels like it accelerates that timeline in the state.
Members of the Church of Jesus Christ.
Members of the Jesus Christ. Members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I can get it all in. We've got plenty of time.
It's a lot.
Okay. Hey, Derrick Brown. He's new as our Attorney General. He's been, inaugurated, whatnot. He's put out his priorities. Of course, we mentioned last week that he's keeping his schedule open, but he's also going to continue all the litigation that was initiated by his predecessor. I think that's the right thing to do. I mean, for now.
Yeah, I guess maybe I need a refresher, but this wasn't just something that our previous attorney general was, I mean, engaging in. This came out of work that was happening in the legislature and concerns, right-headed or otherwise, out of our governor's office. So I feel like there's a political alignment for these to continue. I don't know, Dan, what would you say about
that?
Yeah,
and when you're new, the last thing you want to do if you're new into an office is you want to show up and start, like, slashing things, right?
Yeah, I totally agree.
So this just shows, I think, Derrick's a better manager.
You just keep the momentum of the good things that are happening and move from there. So that's all really good. Dan, just while we have you here, what are a couple of highlights that aren't in the media but that we should be thinking about for this session? I mean, everybody's saying, you know, water and energy and things, higher ed, but what's a gem for our listeners?
Well, I mean, if my bill passes, we are going to actually change the APA style guide so that Utahns will be spelled U-T-A-H-N instead of U-T-A-H-A-N.
This is so
for
Dan.
For academics.
This is so Dan McKay.
I'm pretty into this.
This is so Dan McKay. Good for you. Did you come up with this idea yourself?
I actually was working with Quinn Monson down at BYU. He was talking to me about how difficult it is to get this cited
properly. I've done work with, like, say, American Affairs, and you turn in Utahns without the, you know, the A in it, and they correct it, and you're like, okay, whatever. I'm from Utah.
Yeah.
Yep, there you go. So that's one of the odd things that will happen this session.
That's a good
It'll
gem.
Be a highlight.
Shereen, anything you want to add?
I think we've got three. There are a number of new Democrats that are joining the House that I think are really just strong leaders. They are wonderful people. So I'm excited about some of the new folks that are coming in to represent Democrats in the state in the House.
That's cool. Dan, Representative Birklin resigned. I saw that you actually tweeted about her and that she was a force of nature. And that meant something to me because she's we said on the program last week, she's a strong leader.
Yeah, she really is.
Who is this new person?
I haven't met her yet, so you caught me a little bit flat-footed.
Tierra,
I think is her name.
Tierra?
Yeah,
Oxier.
She seems like she is going to be cut from the same stripes, it seems, from Kira. And so I think in a lot of ways, she will bring her own leadership strength.
That's great.
Yeah, she's, you know, campaigned, I think, for this on having blocked critical race theory, I guess, from being in schools and programming. So it sounds like more of the same.
Shireen's not happy about that.
I just don't think that's a high priority for most Utahns. We're talking about housing costs and the increasing, you know, cost of living in the state and some of the bread and butter issues.
Hey, great discussion with my friend Shireen Gorbani, Dan McKay. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.